Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. We'll begin and talk about healthcare, and then we'll talk about Afghanistan. We'll be joined by a senior advisor to President Obama's special envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan. I'm joined by T.R. Reid, who is a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, the author of 10 books, of course, his latest book, The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. He's one of America's best-known foreign correspondents. His 2008 Frontline documentary, Sick Around the World, under the premise that the U.S. healthcare system is a failure, takes a look at the national healthcare systems of five wealthy countries around the world. The first two countries, the UK and Japan, both places where T.R. Reid has lived while serving as a Washington Post bureau chief. And then he also examined Germany, Taiwan, and Switzerland. Then T.R. Reid, before you came on the air, I was sort of I wouldn't say admonishing the audience, but encouraging the audience to understand the value that you've brought to the table and to this debate by giving the Americans a sense of how the rest of the world does healthcare, and therefore being able to contextualize the system we have here. But in terms of what you've offered to the debate, it must be disappointing to you that the debate itself has been so hijacked down the cul-de-sacs of death panels and other outrageous claims. Do you think that this debate's ever going to get back on track?
Yeah, I hope so, Ian. It's great to be back on your show. I got to say, look, you know, I'm out promoting this book, and it's a bestseller, I'm pleased to say, and that means you got to market it, and I'm marketing it on a lot of Fox stations. And at Fox, their basic position is the U.S. is the greatest in the world. Nobody can do anything better than we can, and so shut up about how other countries do healthcare. But your listeners, I think, are a little more open to the notion that all the other industrialized democracies provide health care for everybody at high quality, and they still spend half as much as we do. So I think we could learn a lot from other countries. I think that's what my book shows. And, you know, in this book, I also demonstrate it's not all socialized medicine out there. Lots of countries cover everybody with private docs, private hospitals, and private insurance. It can be done. I came away pretty optimistic. We could do it. But I agree with you, Ian. I think our debate got off kilter this summer in this notion that, hey, I've got good insurance, so the heck with my neighbor. To me, that's not an American approach to healthcare. That's pretty un-American. I think we're a generous society, and we should provide universal healthcare coverage like all the other countries do. And I know we could, because other countries like us do it and spend less.
Well, I mentioned earlier, before you came on, Thierry, that one of the virtues and even necessities of getting your book is that everybody in America has, if they're a progressive, they have a conservative friend. If they watch MSNBC, they have relatives and friends who are addicted to Fox, and that it is their civic duty to buy this book.
How kind of you.
And give it to their friends to, as you mentioned, when you appear on Fox, the basic attitude is that we're the greatest country on earth and everything is hunky-dory, and we don't need to be told that what happens around the rest of the world. Why do you think, though, just before we get into the details of the book, why do you think President Obama didn't approach it in the way that was, in retrospect, would have, I think, been much, much more successful, and that is to have borrowed from what Senator Moynihan said many, many years ago, that all you have to do is take a couple of words out of the Medicare Act, which mandates health care for people over 65, and just gradually bring it in down every year or so to 55, 45, 35, and then eventually everybody would be covered. It seems such sort of elegantly simple in retrospect, but being a reporter there in Washington, do you have any knowledge of whether anybody ever advocated that to the White House?
Medicare for all would definitely work. I mean, you know, a lot of countries have Medicare for all. That would be private docs, private hospitals, but a public payment scheme. There's no question it would work. And as a matter of fact, when Lyndon Johnson instituted Medicare for America's seniors in 1965, and incidentally, it's a model he borrowed from Canada. That's the Canadian model. The name Medicare is also Canadian. When he did that, his thought was that 5 years later, Medicare would be made available to everybody over 60, and then everybody over 55, and everybody over 50. And if we'd done that, by today, everybody in America would have health care coverage. We wouldn't have this outrageous situation where 22,000 Americans die every year of treatable diseases because they can't afford to see a doctor. That doesn't happen in any other rich country. It wouldn't happen here if we had gone that route. You know, President Obama has said, well, the problem is ideological. People just don't trust the government to provide health care. And I hear this argument all the time. Believe me, you know, I'm giving a talk and somebody says, the government can't even deliver the mail on time. How are they going to cure cancer? You've heard this argument too, Ian. In the first place, the two answers to that, in the first place, when Americans get government-run health care, they really like it. People on Medicare and people on the Veterans Administration have much higher rates of satisfaction than people in private insurance. And in the second place, you know, you could cover everybody without putting them all on Medicare. Many countries cover everybody in the private sector. We could, too. The issue here is that we have never regulated our insurance, health insurance companies the way other countries do, and therefore health insurance doesn't work here. It's the most expensive in the world. It's the most wasteful. America's big for-profit health insurance companies have the highest administrative costs in the world by far. They don't cover everybody. They cover fewer and fewer people every year, and they don't have any control on costs. Costs are going up at double the rate of inflation. So private insurance can work. I mean, I point out in my book, you know, The Healing of America, where I went around the world looking at other countries, private insurance works fine in many countries because the firms are regulated by government. But it hasn't worked in America, but it could.
Well, in fact, in your book, you point out that in Switzerland, if an insurance company does not pay a claim in a timely fashion, the policyholder gets, a free month?
In a timely fashion means 5 days. You ever had a health care claim paid in 5 days in the United States?
Well, in Switzerland,
if they don't pay your claim in 5 days, next month's premium is free. Now, that's better insurance service than any American gets. No American gets that good care. But it's private insurance. I mean, it could work if we were to regulate our insurance companies. And I definitely give this to President Obama. He held up that public option, and it terrified the insurance companies because they don't feel they can compete with federal bureaucrats when it comes to providing insurance. And to stave off the public option, they have agreed to more regulation than they've ever been willing to accept in the past. It still is not as much as you'd see in other countries, but you know they're moving along. And I think for Obama, the public option was always just a bargaining chip, but he's used it pretty cleverly to force the insurance companies to accept things they would not have accepted otherwise.
Well, but on the other hand, T.R. Reid, you could argue that the fact that Max Baucus has played such a strong and central role would indicate that since he is, if he's as far to the left as advocates for healthcare reform have, then we haven't really, the rest of the left doesn't have a voice. And in any negotiation, you always ask for more. You always make bigger claims, and I don't understand how, on the one hand, maybe in his private negotiations with the insurance companies, Obama is using the private option, the public option, as leverage. But in the Baucus situation, which many people think will be the template for a bill, if Max Baucus is as far to the left as it goes, that's hardly a democratic representation of the overall debate.
Yeah, I agree with you. If you agree with me that the goal is universal coverage at reasonable cost, which all the other industrialized countries have, then Max's plan falls far short. It just really doesn't get us there. So I was disappointed in it, too. And I still haven't given up. I still think, come on, if Taiwan can cover everybody, you're telling me the United States of America can't do it? I know we could.
Thierry, you mentioned arguing with those that oppose healthcare reform that they bring up the analogy of the post office. You know what the post office running healthcare. Ironically, actually, of course, the post office does work fairly well. And what the Bush administration did was essentially take money from the post office and give subsidies to UPS and to FedEx, who don't need it, in the sense that Medicare Advantage is a complete giveaway to the insurance companies, where they discovered they can't, as you mentioned, compete with Medicare. So the Republicans essentially gave them this gift of Medicare Advantage, which Obama plans to take away. So how much do you think, and that's the big argument about how much it's going to cost, how much do you think he really can save from within the system itself? Because I don't think, you know, they've even really got into the extent of fraud. They mention it, but not detailed it. And they certainly haven't got into a debate about how lifestyle choices in this country could make a huge difference. Apparently, we waste about $150 billion on obesity and diabetes-related diseases from the appalling diets in America, where you have simultaneous malnutrition and obesity. And then, of course, there's about $100 billion cost from cigarettes. So what's the have you looked at this ledger and are the savings there?
Yeah, there's no question. Look, if you cover everybody, you save a ton of money in many ways, and the proof of this is all the other countries. All the other countries cover everybody and spend half as much per capita as we do. Why? Well, in the first place, if people can go to the doctor when they first feel a pain in their foot, they can get treated, their diabetes can be spotted, and we don't have to pay $130,000 for an amputation and all the other. So you save a lot of money by treating people early. Second, if there's a system that covers everybody, that system, A, has economic clout to set cost controls, but B, this is more important, you get the political will to make the tough choices. If everybody is in the system, then everybody has an interest in seeing that system work efficiently. And, you know, if when these orthopedic surgeons take away $1.2 million a year doing questionable operations, there's really nobody to challenge that now. But if everybody were in the system, then you could say, wait a minute, I'd rather see that money used to help a sick baby or something. So what we've seen in all the other rich countries is when you cover everybody, you get the economic and political power to control costs, and it works.
And I take it that with things like diabetes, if you have a system like the rest of the world has, then these things are identified much, much earlier and treated much earlier. The problem with our system is that so many people, because of the costs and because of the strain that that any kind of sickness has on the family budget, that people procrastinate and delay, and by the time they show up, quite often it's too late.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And, you know, I point out in this book of mine, The Healing of America, that if everybody's in the same system, then that system has a strong incentive to provide preventive medicine. Preventive medicine is good. It relieves human suffering. It eliminates illness, prevents illness. But it's expensive. And so you need an incentive to spend money on it. In America, the average person stays with an insurance plan about 4.8 years, and then you change jobs or your spouse gets a better job and you change. So that insurance company, because their real goal, their corporations, is to pay a dividend to investors, they don't want to spend money to keep you healthy. By the time you get sick, you're going to be somebody else's problem. In contrast, a system like I saw in all the other countries, everybody's in one system, they do want to spend money on preventive care because you're going to be their patient no matter what. And yeah, I think the world, I argue in my book that the world champion of preventive health is Britain, because they are constantly running TV ads and putting up, you know, posters that say, hey, do your feet hurt? If your feet hurt, call this 800 number and we'll send a podiatrist over to your house for free. You know, if you're coughing a lot, call this 800 number and we'll send a nurse to see if you have chronic bronchitis for free. And the reason is it's cheaper to do that than to wait for people to show up seriously ill at the emergency room. They save a ton of money doing that. We could too, but we don't have the incentive structure because we have so many different conflicting systems.
And I assume that those kind of health systems like the British have are much, much better poised for an H1N1 type outbreak as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They are ready, and they, of course, in those systems, shots are free, the vaccination is free, of course, so more people get it, and they go out and try to solicit people to get it. Yeah, I used to walk down the street. You walk down Oxford Street in London, you know, it's their Fifth Avenue. I have this in the book, too. You walk down the Fifth Avenue of London in October, November, and what do you see? You see a bunch of pretty girls in American cheerleader outfits. Pretty unusual in Britain, you know, short little skirts and pom-poms, you know. Not the kind of thing you see a lot of. But they see this in American movies, and they think it's really sexy, you know. And I go up to these cheerleaders, young, pretty young British girls, and what are you doing here? And the woman says, well, have you had your flu job? Have you had your flu job? Have you had your flu shot? No, I haven't. She says, well, go right in that door behind me. It's free. Now, you know, that's preventive medicine. And the reason they do it is because they figured out over time it saves money when everybody's in the system. We don't really have the economic incentive to do that. In fact, there's a flu shot drive where I live in Colorado right now. Go to any grocery store, $55. You know, that's pretty expensive. A lot of people aren't going to be able to do that. So you just get, I argue this in my book, you just get better preventive health if you cover everybody. That's got to be the first step. Let's just decide as a rich society that we're going to see to it that everybody who needs health care can see a doctor.
Also in the book, Thierry, your own personal quest, if you will, for healthcare in terms of your own, what was an old football injury, became a sort of test case, did it not, for how the rest of the world handles healthcare? Tell me that story because it's quite charming.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a football injury, as I keep pointing out on Fox. It was a military injury. I injured my shoulder when I was on duty in the U.S. Navy, unlike Glenn Beck or Bill O'Reilly, who didn't bother to serve our country. I served in the U.S. Navy and injured my shoulder. And the Navy fixed it up. In Bethesda Naval Hospital, they gave me a serious operation. There's a stainless steel screw in my shoulder now. But over time, it hurts and it's frozen up. It doesn't move very well. So I was going around the world for this book to figure out how other countries manage to provide health care for everybody and spend half as much as we do. And I figured I'll take my shoulder along, too, and since I'm going to the doctor in the hospital, see if anybody can cure it. And what I found was a pretty broad range. You know, Ian, you've heard this argument, well, other countries, they limit patients' choices and they keep you waiting, and that's how they cover everybody.
Rationing, they call it, yeah.
Yeah, well, everybody rations care, including the U.S. But it turns out that wasn't the case. In France, in Japan, in Germany, in Switzerland, those countries offered me more choices than I was offered in the American system than my American insurance company would have paid for, and much faster. In Japan, I called this famous hospital, Keio University Hospital, could I come see the orthopedic surgeon sometime, get an appointment? They said, oh, why make an appointment? Just drop in this afternoon. The same afternoon, I was in the office of one of Japan's most distinguished orthopedic surgeons, and he said, well, let's see, here's what we could do. We could cut out your shoulder and put in an artificial shoulder. We could give you monthly cortisone shots to deal with the pain. We could do physical therapy, and that would give you more movement. We could do traditional Chinese herbal medicine, or we could do acupuncture. Any of those, they're all covered by Japanese insurance, and he would have started them in about 2 days. In the end, I did do the acupuncture, and here's what they did, Ian. They twirled their needles in my left thigh to treat my right shoulder. It was interesting. It didn't hurt. It didn't help a bit, but what the heck, you know. Insurance paid for it over there. So, so that's what I did. I took my shoulder around the world. I was looking for a cure for my shoulder, but look, that's a personal issue. I was looking for a much bigger cure, and that is some way to fix America's unfair and outrageously expensive healthcare system. And, you know, the result is I came out fine on both ends. My shoulder, I have less pain and more movement than when I started. And in terms of a healthcare system, I know we could cover everybody, and we could do it in an American way in the private sector, because lots of countries do. Or, as you suggested, we could take the Canadian-Australian approach and have government insurance, Medicare, apply to everybody. That would work very well, too. Or you could have a mix. If people want to buy from Blue Cross and Blue Shield or you know, United Health, some Aetna, some big private company, let them do it. And if they want to buy from Medicare, get their insurance that way, let them do that. The insurance companies don't like giving the choice because Medicare has lower premiums and generally a better benefits package than most private plans. But, you know, all those approaches would work. So I know we could fix it if we first made the moral commitment, and that's the crucial point I make in my book. The first thing a country has to do is morally commit to cover everybody, provide health care for everybody. You know, Ian, I'm sure you've seen a lot of religious leaders in America kind of deplore the fact of these empty cathedrals in Europe. You know, nobody goes to church anymore. I think in the Netherlands, only 3% of the people go to church on Sunday. They've lost their faith. It's a post-religious society. You've heard all that.
Oh, right. You know, funnily enough, Tiarina, I was just driving out to the beach yesterday in Malibu, and there was an Episcopalian church offering wine tasting and chocolate tasting
to get people in. I just heard this argument. I'm Catholic, and in the sermon at Mass this morning was, oh, those Europeans, they've lost their faith. They're not Christian anymore. And yet, as I point out in my book, somehow all those European countries provide health care for the least of their brethren. They take care of everybody, and in the United States, we've never made that commitment. And I said to my priest after, given a country that has agreed to provide health care to anybody who gets sick versus a country where tens of thousands of people die because they can't see a doctor, where would Jesus be more comfortable? And my priest didn't quite take the bait. He pushed me off. But anyway.
Well, I thank you so much, T.R. Reid.
Okay. Thanks, Ian.
Great. Yeah. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking then with T.R. Reid, the foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. He's authored about 10 books, but his most recent book is The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. We are indeed going to be joined in a moment by Vali Nasser, who is a senior advisor to President Obama's special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's the author of a new book, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of a New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our Future. And this is a look at the Middle East and the Southwest Asia through the lens of somebody that's actually actively involved in policy as it's happening now. And has also written some of the more important books about the Middle East, in particular Iran, The Shia Revival, a New York Times bestseller, and, of course, this new book, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of a New Muslim Middle Class, and What It Means for Our World, which we're offering up here as a premium today. Vali Nasser is a professor of international relations at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a senior fellow at the Dubai Initiative at Harvard University John F. Kennedy School of Government. And Vali Nasser, thank you so much for joining us here. I was always troubled throughout the Bush-Cheney years, by the war on terror, in the sense that the word Islamo-fascist was thrown around a lot, and I never did understand how you could fight a kind of religious war, particularly if we have a constituency in this country which you may well be able to describe as Christo-fascist, since there's a lot of, we have our own theocrats over here. Many of them, of course, in fact, all of them support the Bush administration and the diminishing Republican Party. But the main irony that always struck me, Vali Nasser, was that it seems so counterintuitive to sort of talk about a war of clash of civilizations and all of this stuff as though it's inevitable, when the reality is, as far as I can see, that no Christian or Jew could ever dissuade a young Muslim who was entertaining Islamic radicalism. The only people that could dissuade somebody from becoming a radical in the Islamic world would be a moderate Islamist, surely.
That's true. In other words, any kind of a change to the way in which followers of a religion view society, view politics, view how religious values ought to be reflected in politics, those changes have to come from within a tradition. And this is how it happened in the Christian history. This is how it happened in Jewish history. And this is how it also has to happen in Islamic history, in a sense that change has to come. There is no doubt that change ought to come. And there's a lot of issues within the Islamic tradition regarding politics, extremism, and the like that have to be solved. But there has to be a dynamic from within to do that. And that is what I discuss in my book, Forces of Fortune, that these changes are most likely to come when you have the rise of a business-tied, business-related, private sector-based middle class, which was also the engine of change in European history, the engine of change in India, China, and also in Latin America and Eastern Europe.
And it seems to me, Valinasa, that we are witnessing the dichotomy of that struggle in Iran today on the streets. And just over the weekend, the opposition, who were under tremendous duress and threat, came out on Quds Day, the day of the Iranian regime celebrates its solidarity with the Palestinians, Quds being in the Jerusalem and the Dome of the Rock. But one of the things that was extraordinary about it, apart from the fact that these people are exhibiting extraordinary courage and that a couple of the leaders were roughed up, the former president, Khatami and Karoubi. But what I understand that a lot of the protesters in the street were shouting was they were saying, no to Lebanon, no to Hamas, we live for Iran. So is there something going on there in terms of the internal debates within Iran that the people want a better life for themselves in Iran and they're not happy with this government, which is essentially run by the AIGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, and their priorities?
Well, the people, not just in Iran, but in many other places in the Muslim world, do like better lives for themselves. And in fact, it is proof of the fact that people everywhere around the Muslim world are like people in other parts of the world. In other words, they're driven by economic interests. They are trying to live better lives. They want better lives for their children. They want economic opportunities. And ultimately, all politics is about these hard issues. We often may look at the Muslim world and think that robot-like every single Muslim is driven by the religious text and by what the fanatics say. There are a minority of Muslims who are driven by ideology and fanaticism or religious text. But by and large, majority of Muslims have secular needs, secular demands, and their politics at its core is secular. Namely, it's about bread and butter issues and it's about distribution of power. Now, in many countries around the Muslim world, what we see demand for change, we see demand for democracy, we see demand for reform. These demands are strongest when they are where you have free markets, you have the presence of capitalism, where you have certain degree of integration of the economies into the global economy. In other words, the force for change, for democracy, for freedom in the Muslim world, as was also, you mentioned, witnessed in countries like Iran, for it to be successful, it has to be anchored in some kind of a good economic development and economic progress. Societies that are poor, that don't have a middle class, that don't have a business sector, that don't have a private sector, are not able to support successful democratic movements. And therefore, what we see is this fight over democracy and freedom. But more important than that is that fight will be successful if it's supported by economic freedom. You mentioned the case of Iran. My book deals with this. The Forces of Fortune deals with the background to this, that the rise of civil society in Iran that is now supporting economic freedoms and, as you mentioned, is showing its political presence on the streets, began to develop in Iran when in the 1990s the economy began to open up and there was a certain degree of private sector activity, which then gave rise to a middle class in Iran that was interested in political freedoms, social freedoms, economic freedoms, wanted conspicuous consumption, wanted cultural change to support its newfound economic wealth. And that became the basis for the kind of political flowering that then began to unfold. So, in other words, these debates that we are seeing in Muslim countries are not sort of isolated debates between religion and secularism or political freedom and governments. These are not debates in a vacuum. These debates are strongest when there is a private sector that wants to support them.
But it seems to me, though, Vali Nasser, and I know that you're a senior advisor to the President Obama's special envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan, but the reason I'm talking about Iran is that it seems to me that Iran is key to the region. If you have I don't know what the numbers are, but it's pretty clear from what happened after this stolen election that there was a tremendous manifestation of anger and fury at this government because they essentially had rigged the elections at any rate and they chose the candidates, but they seem to have gone too far and really spontaneously brought this this manifestation of anger and frustration, and I'm not sure whether it represents an entire majority of the people, but it's so clear that you have an extremely educated, entrepreneurial class of people who simply are fed up with this theocratic government that's stealing them blind, that's now been taken over by fanatics who have a very, very aggressive and dangerous foreign policy. And you would think that there has to be a way for the United States to connect with these people. And ironically, the Lash regime, the Bush-Cheney regime, did the reverse. They took away the Taliban on one side and Saddam on the other. And by U.S. Army showing up right next door, they undercut the Iranian opposition and played right into the hands of the Ahmadinejads. So is there... I'm sure you and company and other people in the administration understand these things, but what is the how do you do that? How do you liberate a people from within who don't have the guns?
Well, you know, the larger question is that is why and how did this entrepreneurial, educated class that demands greater relationship with the world and political freedoms actually come about in Iran? Mm-hmm. And how can it be strengthened? And how can it reach a critical point after which its political interests would become unstoppable? And that is where essentially the question that we have to focus on. And in the case of Iran, as you mentioned, this class, which is now became so evident to everybody that is capable of operating on Twitter and on Facebook and on the Internet and is savvy and wants better relations with the world and wants political freedom, has its roots in the emergence of a private sector in Iran in the 1990s and the 2000s. And the opening of the economy provided a new middle class in Iran that was wealthier, that saw its interest in trade and commerce and greater relations with the world and wants those to be expanded. And like middle classes everywhere, likes to consume and likes to have cultural freedoms so it can spend on things that it likes. But it's not big enough yet. And ultimately, the question is, how do you get it to become much larger so that its political voice would become louder. And in that sense, it is the same challenge everywhere else. In other words, when you look at the Arab world, when you look at Pakistan, when you look at other corners of the Muslim world, you see the same trait, that the political forces that want freedom, that want change, that want better relations with the world, have ties to the economy and have ties to private sector development. And it is those ties and the wealth that the private sector development generates that then pushes them in demanding greater freedoms and greater cultural diversity in their societies. And we can think of it the other way around, is that if we really want the Muslim world to turn its back on fundamentalism and extremism definitively and from within begin to marginalize those forces, we have to think of how can it be that the majority of the Muslim world can develop a vested interest in values that would do that. And the only way that is going to happen is if the majority of the Muslim population sees its political and social interests as tied to participation in the global economy. And for that to happen, you have to have economic growth, and you have to have development of business, and you have to have commerce become much more important, international commerce to become much more important to the welfare of the people than it is currently the case.
But, well, in terms of helping the Iranian middle class develop and become more connected to the rest of the world, first of all, it would seem to me that it's totally counterintuitive then to have sanctions against these people. If we can just look at what the model of sanctions for 60, 70 years with Cuba, they've done nothing but consolidate the power of the Castro brothers and impoverish the people in that country to the point where they risk their lives to get out of the place. So that is seems to me to be counterintuitive. And secondly, in terms of the international community and their dealings with Iran, whether to have more sanctions, and now there's this discussion that President Obama has given Russia a gift by taking away these worthless missile systems, therefore Russia should be more cooperative in terms of sanctions. First of all, I don't believe that the Russians really want Iran to be anything but a pariah state, because if Iran joined the community of nations, and particularly the West, then they'd be able to sell their gas through the existing pipelines to Turkey into the Europe, and that would be a competition for Gazprom. So walk us through some of this, what, at least assuming that you agree with me to some degree, what seems to be our counterintuitive policies.
Well, as I argue in my book, The Forces of Fortune, the issue is much larger than a sort of a narrow angle of how do you manage a particular foreign policy crisis like Iran's nuclear program at a particular juncture in time. In order to have an economic opening in the Muslim world that can support political freedoms, that can support cultural diversity, that can reduce the scope of fundamentalism and extremism, and that can restrict hardline regimes like the one that we have in Iran, in other places in the Muslim world, to follow their policies. We have to have a much broader economic approach to the Muslim world that not just deals with the narrow issue of sanctions, but much more broadly promotes trade, encourages deregulation of the economies, encourage the rise of entrepreneurship. We have to follow the same policies that the IMF and the World Bank and the European Community followed with countries in Latin America and East Asia and Eastern Europe, in order to encourage the opening of those countries to global commerce and global trade. In other words, I would argue it's the other way around. Rather than thinking about what set of restrictions work or don't work at this point in time, we have to have a much broader global strategy that is not just about Iran, but it's also about all Muslim countries from Bangladesh and Pakistan and the Arab world all the way to Africa, that our strategy vis-a-vis the Muslim world should not be defined just by a narrow issue like the nuclear issue or the Arab-Israeli issue at this point in time, but we should have a much grander strategy of how do you integrate the Muslim world into the global economy. Because once that happens, once the Muslim world begins to get integrated into the global economy, at the very heart of the Muslim world, you will have the rise of a economically prosperous middle class that will have then a vested interest in that relationship with the Western world and will become the engine for creating bridges between the Muslim world and the West. And it is at that point in time that the anti-Western forces in the Muslim world will begin to lose their influence and will begin to become marginalized. So I think, you know, the process we have to think is much broader. And there are plenty of evidence that this can work. When you look at countries like Malaysia and Turkey, which are the most countries that are most integrated into the global economy, that they are part of the whole trade and commerce structure of the world, those also happen to be countries with the wealthiest and most well-to-do middle classes. Those are countries that are also most open politically, Turkey being, the only really Muslim democracy. And there are also countries with a great deal of pluralism. And when you look at these countries, even the religious people in these countries understand that their welfare, their economic interest is dependent on preserving their relationship with the West. And they therefore don't support the kinds of ideas, extremisms, fundamentalisms that are likely to disturb that relationship.
Well, Vali Nasser, again, I'm talking with Vali Nasser, the author of Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. A book we're offering up is a premium to support Background Briefing at 818-985-5735. The book, of course, does deal with that broader historical issue that you've brought up here, and there's no question. And I don't mean to keep turning the conversation back to the mechanics of and choices that we have in terms of our foreign policy, but of course Americans are very concerned, and rightly so, that we have wars that the current president inherited, but nevertheless the Afghan war is being escalated in terms of resources, both financial and in terms of troops. And in terms of the Muslim world that you've just outlined, Vali Nasser, I would suggest perhaps that Afghanistan would be the most challenging simply because it's the most backward. It's largely a country the size of Texas with thousands and thousands of villages, very little rural infrastructure. It's not like Iraq, for example. I just saw a documentary on CNN that Christiane Amanpour did about Afghanistan. And I must say it's completely consistent with what you're saying in terms of your new book, Forces of Fortune. There is, even in this country that has had a lot of xenophobia and distrust of the outside world, apparently the majority of Afghans are young. I think 60% are under 20 or something extraordinary like that. And they profiled Afghanistan's version of American Idol, I think it's called Afghan Star, and how incredibly popular it is. And conversely, there's the second most popular program on this same television show is a program for the conservative religious people, where people recite verses of the Quran and win the prize for being able to do it well. And it's all run by an Afghan-Australian entrepreneur. Yes. And it was so interesting what's heartbreaking about it is you see the yearning on the part of these people to have a normal life and to have the benefits that the other people in the rest of the world take for granted. But the truth of the matter is they just don't have a government.
Right. Well, you know, you raised a number of very interesting issues that are important in thinking about the whole issue of extremism, which is where you began with. One is that the Muslim world as a whole is incredibly young. It's not just Afghanistan. You know, country after country, when you look at the majority of the population is the youth. which is they are 25 and below. There are a number of countries in which the majority of the population is actually in their teenage years. And that means that you have a very dynamic society that is coming from below. That is, as is the case whenever you have a lot of young people, cause instability. But it also means that it puts a lot more pressure to actually have the economy working so you'll be able to provide jobs for them, because you'd think that down the road, if the majority of your population are young people and there is no economic opportunity for them, then there's only one direction they can go in, and that is to adopt, to become antisocial, adopt fanatical extremist ways, and become source of trouble. And economic growth in any society, not just Afghanistan, but much larger prosperous countries, can by and large these days only happen if you integrate into the global economy, if you find investment from the outside, if you find something that you can sell to wealthier countries so that you generate trade. And the only exception to this rule are countries that are oil rich, where they can basically rely on their oil revenue. But other countries that don't have the luxury of oil, whether it's Pakistan, Bangladesh, you know, Jordan, or Afghanistan, would have to find a way to trade and to sell things. The other issue that you raised is when you gave the example of American, the Afghan idol, is that the young people in the Muslim world are already very integrated into the global information system. About a quarter of Afghanistan's population now use cell phones. About 30% of Pakistanis use cell phones. There's a lot more interaction that is happening on Twitter, on Facebook, by texting, on the internet, than we assume looking at it from the outside, which means that actually the Muslim world is much more integrated into the world when it comes to technology and information, but it's not very well integrated into the world when it comes to economics. And therefore, it is not a surprise that we see this sort of jarred view of the Muslim world, where we think that the youth really would like to be part of the global culture, and Afghan Idol ends up being such a big hit in Afghanistan, but that you also have a great deal of attraction for anti-Western fundamentalist voices and in worst cases, extremism, because the population still is not integrated into the same global economy and global forces that the rest of the world are integrated in. Now, you know, in the past, because of 9/11, a lot of our focus has been on the most, if you would, backward or difficult cases in the Muslim world, like places like Yemen or Somalia or Afghanistan, to get things right over there in the hope that they would then set an example for the rest of the Muslim world. But, you know, that actually has not worked very well, and it would be much better for us to focus on countries that are closest to success. And that's what I argue in my book, Forces of Fortune, that, you know, countries like Turkey or Malaysia or larger Arab countries like Morocco or Algeria are much more likely to be able to actually make the transition into the global economy, because a lot of them have an educated population, they have a better workforce, they have things that the outside world could invest in, and they have labor that can produce finished products for sale in Western markets. And it is much more likely that those countries can go through the same economic transition that Argentina or Poland or South Korea went through than Afghanistan, Somalia, or Yemen can. And if these larger Muslim countries were able to make this transition into the global economy and were successful at it, and they became prosperous, and as a result of that prosperity, you had many more cultural activities in them, and eventually you would have democracy, much like what has happened in Turkey in the past 10 years, then they would essentially serve as a model for the rest of the Muslim world. So we in the West don't have to fix everything or every corner of the Muslim world, we should rather focus on helping the countries that have the greatest potential of making the transition into the global political, economic, and culture to do that, and then let them essentially serve as the model for the next level. When Turkey, the country of Turkey, changed its economy, joined the global economy, became a democracy, and became a Muslim democracy, more importantly, the prosperous Muslim democracy, everybody in the Muslim world began to look at Turkey as a model. It became the point that of debate for everybody. And there is a Turkish effect of every country thinking, you know, how they can emulate Turkey, or what is it that Turkey has done that that they can follow. Even the harder cases, countries like Pakistan and Iran, still have enough private sector activity within them that in the right circumstances could be influenced by this trend if it begins to genuinely take off in the Muslim world.
Well, just in the last minute then, Vali Nasser, just in terms of your book, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class, your chapter on Pakistan, Pakistan's Horror and Hope, which one is it?
There is no doubt that Pakistan is facing a great challenge. It has a lot of extremism within it. It has threatened the country over the years. There has been failures of the economy. The government has at times been weakest. But the question is, how will Pakistan turn the corner? And if Pakistan is to turn the corner, if it's going to become a stable democracy, if it's going to defeat extremism, if its population is going to become interested and vested in a better future that is based on better relations with the world, that it's going to adopt a very different approach to religion, society, and politics, there has to be real economic growth within Pakistan. And there has to be the rise of a middle class that can help that country move in the right direction. Now, we've seen evidence of this in the past. In other words, whenever the middle class has done well in Pakistan, the country has been most stable and most moderate, and forces of extremism have been most contained. Whenever the middle class has been under pressure, has been weakened, has been beaten down, then, you know, you have a surge in extremism, and you have a greater instability. So the question is that ultimately everybody would like Pakistan to make the transition to a stable economic prosperity and to a stable democracy. But for that to happen, it is not enough for us to say that, well, Pakistan ought to moderate or this and that ought to happen. We have to help the most prosperous, the most global-looking, the most part of Pakistan to get bigger, that part of Pakistan that is interested in good relations with the rest of the world, that would have a vested interest in open trade ties with the rest of the world. We have to help that part of the Pakistan become a much louder voice. So we've been going through this discussion in country after country, it's the same issue. In other words, we know what the problems are. We know where we would like these countries to go. What we have to understand in the West is that the only way these countries can go in the direction that we want them is that if they have a strong middle class, which is the only class that has a vested interest in good relations with the rest of the world.
Well, just as we close out here, Vali Nasser, and of course we do have here in Los Angeles an enormous Iranian diaspora. They refer to this place as Tehranjalis, and we also have a lot of Pakistani and Afghan diaspora. So we have listeners out there who can also play a constructive role in this debate. What would your final advice to people be in terms of, in the overall context of the way we see the Islamic world in these cartoonish and destructive caricatures, this is really, in many ways, a very hopeful story.
Right. Well, first of all, the diasporas are extremely important. We can look at the Indian diaspora and the important role it played in helping the Indian middle class to become so much more important to India, and as a consequence, help India become a global economic force and a political power player. And, you know, whether it's Pakistani, Iranian, Turkish, Arab diasporas are very well positioned to help the middle classes in their own countries achieve that capability. But I think, you know, in the final analysis is that we have to be realistic. There is a problem in the Muslim world. There's problems of extremism, bad government, dictatorship, confrontation. There are wars. There are insurgencies. And we would like to see the Muslim world move in a direction that would gradually stabilize its politics and open it up to the world. And above all, we want the Muslim world to have stable, friendly and positive relations with the West. But we have to understand that this is not going to happen unless people in the Muslim world and the people in the West have a vested interest in that kind of a relationship with one another. And historically, whether we go to 16th century Europe or to 20th century, 21st century relations between the West and other parts of the world, that these kinds of positive relationships only really grow root and become enduring if they are based on open trade and commercial and economic relations. And so we need to foster that with the Muslim world. We have very little economic and trade relationships with very large parts of the Muslim world. And therefore, it's not a surprise that our relationship with the Muslim world are often so fragile. And then at another level is that any part of the world that we look, where you have stable democracies, where you have prosperity, where you have moderation, where you have cultural and political openness, you have prospering middle classes that dominate society, economics, and politics. That's true of the United States, that's true of Europe, and that's true of the newly rising parts of the world, from Brazil to China to India to Korea to Latin America. Wherever we look, the positive stories of the past several decades are all associated with the rise of a new middle class that is tied to the global economy and has a vested interest in openness, prosperity, and good relations with the West. So, you know, that in the Muslim world has to be encouraged, and it's possible because we've seen it succeed in Turkey, we've seen it succeed in Malaysia. We have to help it succeed where it's asking for success, which is in countries from Iran to Indonesia, to Pakistan, to Bangladesh, that there is this fight by this middle class that is trying to elbow its way in. It's asking for political freedoms. It's asking for cultural openness. But it's not enough for us to say that we want it to succeed and we support it. The only way it can succeed is by becoming economically stronger and therefore shaping the future of those countries. Therefore, my argument in this book is that the big battle for the future of the Muslim world is not over religion and over politics. The big battle for the future of the Muslim world is over free markets. If that battle is won by the middle class inside and by the Western support from the outside, then the Muslim world will be transformed in the right direction.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles and for your book, Vali Nasser, The Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking then with Vali Nasser, who's Professor of International Relations at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's also a Senior Fellow at the Dubai Initiative at Harvard University, John F. Kennedy School of Government, and he is a Senior Advisor to President Obama's Special Envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the Associate Producer, Jenny Coolidge, the Assistant Producer, Anthony Castillo, the Assistant Producer, and Melissa Figueroa, the Engineer.